Okay, this is part two with Bob Carr. It's November 3rd, 2008. We've done a bit of Bob Carr's early life, the influence of Indian culture on him, and he set up being a channel in Portland. Now he's going to move to Seattle. So Bob, you were saying you had a bookstore in Portland before you went to Seattle.
Yeah, it was a little bookstore center. And I had rented a Victorian house on Broadway Street, right across from the Journal, Portland Journal newspaper. And I had a footnote to this. You see, I was 23 years old, something like that. And people used to say, you're an old soul. You have all this knowledge and so forth. But I found it difficult to convince people of what I was saying and to attract an audience. And so there's a question of authority here. I was too young to be an authority. And so, I feel that perhaps my interest in being involved as a channel was in a way to get around that issue, that there was something else added to my nature, to my personality. Something else was speaking. And that gave a much more an authoritative ring to the what was happening. You understand?
To this young man.
Yeah, to this young man. Now this young man was a channel for something, far wiser, far older, and far... in know of things, shall we say. So that had a part to play in my own psychological nature. And,
when you say it had a part to play, you mean it is something that you were conscious of or something that determined your attitude later? What's it mean that it had a part to play, that you had to be you had to have this gimmick?
I was open to that kind of process.
Because you wanted to appear wise,
I wanted to express, what I felt was what I understood. I think, if a poet writes a poem or a film producer makes a movie, they want to share that. And so, if you're a philosopher, you want to share your philosophical insights with people. And I think I was a born teacher, of sorts, I'll say that.
And yeah, so you were a precocious spiritual philosopher. Precocious,
right.
Spiritual philosopher.
And so I wanted to find a method, a way to express this. And being very young, people would suspect, oh, he doesn't know very much. He's just a kid, But what I tapped into was very... very, profound, I thought. So,
It was profound for your age, for the time. To be reading Krishnamurti, that was pretty avant-garde.
Yeah. The thing is, I was semi-conscious all the time during these sessions. So I could listen in, as it were. In the beginning, not so much, but later it became, so I was very conscious of it. And when people were coming and sitting with me and pouring out their heart, their problems, I could see that they weren't any different than anybody else, I remember there was a fairly famous philosopher who made his living by giving talks all over the country, and he booked a session with me. And during that time, he poured out his heart to all his misgivings and his feelings and his screw-ups in life. So I saw, this guy who gives talks on how to live, how to be spiritual, and how to function, he himself is in need of help, So that gave a great insight to me, that we're all... in the same boat, as it were, And no one had the answer, really, you know. So we're just hoping we have the answer, so to speak. So we live in hope. Hope that what we're doing is going to lead us into some kind of promised land, shall we say, that the gurus and the psychologists and the philosophers and the educational people involved in our colleges that are presenting that they know the facts that will help us in life. And the politicians too, of course. They're the whores offering to help solve our problems. And of course they don't.
Right. It seems to me that the brain is incomplete. The brain or human consciousness is incomplete. So it's actually looking to fill it in. And what you talk about, hope, is the most natural nature of consciousness. It's right, always looking forward to fill in. We call it hope, whatever, but that desire to fill in, if you really see that coldly, that is what everybody's expressing. I say, well, what's coming next?
Hello. You see, we feel separate from life.
Yeah, incomplete.
We've separated ourselves with this intellectual, mental, you know, language, culture, that we've developed, you know, for thousands of years. And this, unfortunately, it has helped us in many ways to live in a more productive life in terms of ease and science and know-how. But at the same time, it's separated us from our fellow, from nature, shall I say, from the natural world. And that makes us feel incomplete. And so we want to fill that gap if we can. We want to find out how to become united again. And that's the search. That's also the sorrow of mankind, this separation.
But the more you know that your consciousness is incomplete, even nature is incomplete, the more you kind of accept that, then you aren't as upset by the sorrow of it.
Well, I don't know. I find it the other way around. So.
The more you don't accept it.
No, the more I know that there is a problem, which is the separation we have, the more acute the problem is to me, the more I see that, what the hell am I doing about it? Am I doing anything about it? Or am I just talking about it? Or do I take a pill to feel better, you know?
You get disturbed by it. I'm claiming the more you know of the incompleteness, that you get a stillness. You're saying no, you don't. No. You don't.
I see the dichotomy of it. You see the problem here, that there's no urgency if you just are complacent to it and you take a pill, and take a feel good pill of some kind, you know. You say, oh, yeah, I see the problem, okay, but it's a problem, I'm not going to solve it, maybe, so I'll just, you know. But for me, it hits me at a level of more of a disturbing level to me. My God, what am I doing about it? And I find out I'm doing nothing.
I'm just, yeah, but you know you can't do anything about it.
No, I know, there's nothing I can do about it. So it makes it all the more frightening, all the more terrifying.
Well, isn't that what the R. Crumb said the philosophers were? They were the worry warts. You're a worry wart.
Yeah. Yeah.
A sophisticated worry wart.
Bob, but at the same time, Bob, you do become more relaxed. You do become less involved that there's something you can do. So that whole search starts to crumble and come to an end. And when you see that there's absolutely nothing you can do, then you become more relaxed.
And well, that's what I was saying. That's what I was saying.
So you do become less burdened by the struggle. But still, you're focused more on the problem. That's what I'm saying. You're focused.
I agree.
More.
That's the doubleness. The doubleness in human consciousness.
Right.
The more
right.
you can handle the slack, the poise,
the greater
you can go into the pain, so to speak, and
you walk
see what's
the razor's
happening.
Edge.
yeah. But you're living both sides. You're not necessarily in the middle. You can experience both sides.
Yeah.
But the two sides collapse into a razor's edge, and then they separate again. And I call that tactility, the oscillating, the sine wave, the going up, the down, the back and forth while being detached from that movement. You can't express, you can't image the doubleness. Any image I make is appropriate for a second, but then that's a trap, and it's not what the thing is.
Yeah, right, yeah. Well, it's you want to communicate, and we have to use these symbols, these ideas to communicate. Otherwise, we would just be sitting dumb, you know, silent.
Right. Now, that raises a point.
It may not be so bad.
Right. But the raise a point I was going to bring up yesterday, and I thought, well, it'll come up at some point, so I didn't struggle to get it in. But what it is that the idea that what the description is not the object is one side of the debate. The other side is that the word is very important, onomatopoeically speaking, that you can't know something properly unless you have the right word for it and the right description. So there you have the doubleness. You can take one side or the other or be aware of both sides. That yes, the description is not the object, but the description does make you see the object. And the Eskimos used to say, how can I know stone without the word stone? And the whole tradition of Alan Watts and Krishnamurti is to emphasize the one side where the description is not the object. But McLuhan used to emphasize the other side, that the object is only known through the description.
True.
The object
exists because there's a description of it. You're describing it. And that description, philosophically, is not describing the object accurately, you know, actually, we'll say.
Yes. So,
and it's keeping you, and it's keeping you separated. As long as I have an image about something, then I'm looking at that as a separation. I'm separated from it, looking at it. I'm looking at it. I am looking at it. So if that collapses, there's no description, there's no tree, there's no grass, there's no cow, you see. But we can't live that way, you know. We have to have words, we have to have these descriptions, or you know, we would just fall apart, you know. But the animals are living in that world, more or less.
We like to fantasize that they communicate. You know, the dolphins and whales are kind of communicating, and they don't get bogged down in it. But I don't know if they communicate. I don't know. I hear all these birds chirping here, you know. What are they doing?
Everything's, we're all sending out signals to protect ourselves. And so they're doing the same thing. You know, yeah, they're communicating with signals, and these are evolved through time, and are part of the instinctive nature of our brain. You know, it's how our brain is operating. Our brain is protecting this body. You know, that's what it's designed for. So keep it going at all cost. Life wants to express itself. You know, that's what it is, an expression, and that's the drive to exist, and. Once you get a handle on that, and you see that that it's perfectly natural to express, and you don't hold back, that you find out that each individual or each expression of life is individually different. There's no two snowflakes alike, no two humans alike, no two hairs on your head alike. Everything is individually different. And that's the mystery, the beauty of what life is. It's this tremendous, intelligent expression of individuality. Okay?
I got that. And when you were talking about the protection, that's another way of talking about consciousness is imperfect, incomplete. So it's paranoid, or it's timid, it's searching. Searching is part of the protective mechanism.
Right. Yeah. When I first stood up on the grassy plains in Africa, a million years ago, I was concerned I might get gobbled up by some lion, you know.
Right.
So I developed all this protective nature, all this protective structure. And the brain just, you know, evolved it very rapidly, quickly. And
I would say that what's interesting, the life energy, I think Krishnamurti said emotion is the present. You never know what emotion you're going to feel as you go through the day. And that it's like you're a river, it's coming through you, and all of a sudden you feel down, or you feel excited, and then it passes. That's another confusing factor of consciousness, is that you never know what you're going to feel the next day, and these feelings come from who knows where, right?
Yeah.
That's
look, the emotions are just another form of thought. It's just a thinking process going on. It's the synaptic connections sparking, you know, making these feelings. Feelings and thoughts, thinking, all the same. It's just we call them emotions, but they aren't any different than thinking. They're just another aspect of thought.
Thought is emission of signals.
Thought is the recognition of memory, projecting an image about what it's looking at, what it's experiencing. Whether it's an interior, subjective experience, or an objective experience. There really is no difference between the objective world and the interior world.
Yet there is perceived a difference even before the culture comes in.
Yeah.
That's the unity and the individuality, what I call the blocking and the merging. We're all one, merge, but we block and maintain our separateness. And the juggling of that leads to emitting radiations of thought, which has emotional colors, but they're thoughts.
Yeah.
And that is all there is to say to a young person.
Right. Good luck. Good luck, buddy. But anyway.
Well, that keeps you employed. You can say it again.
Yeah. What happened in Portland then, I was running out of, you know, interest in the local people, and I had been going to Seattle, making contacts there, giving talks at a Stewart Hotel, and a lot of people were becoming interested in this new kid on the block, and so this one lady, Grace Chapman, invited me to come to Seattle. She said she would buy a house for me to live in, and we'd go open a center, and I would do my work there. So this was an opportunity, I thought, and so I decided to shift from Portland, because a prophet hath no honor in his own land, as the saying goes. So I thought, well, I'd go to Seattle, and I'll be new, you know, and maybe I can expand this center idea that I had, I wanted to do. And no doubt that idea came from my experience at the Vedanta Temple. You know, I went to the temple for about a year. I was a student there, you know, a chela is the term, the Indian term. And I wanted to be a swami too. But I knew I couldn't be an honest swami because you have to be born in India. You know, you have to be a cow first, and then after so many lifetimes of being cows, you eventually might become a human, and then maybe a swami. So I knew that my chances for being a swami were out. So the next best thing was to be an Americanized version of that. So I thought, well, Seattle's probably the next step for me. So I moved to Seattle. I'm being very cold and cold front and honest with you.
No, that's good. You know that kid, the Maharishi, 13-year-old guru? Not Maharishi, the Beatle guy, but Maharishi or something, who showed up in San Francisco. Yeah, he showed up in San Francisco in 71. We had him there, and we went to a talk with him. He was 13 years old. You were a little later version of that kind of thing, at least locally. You were spiritually precocious.
Yeah, he had his mother backing him, and I think he sells cars now in Los Angeles. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no,
he's
I heard.
He's a used car salesman.
That was a joke. But no, he didn't have a very glorious fate.
He short-lasted. Yeah. The Beatle guru had more success. He got a lot of money. He lived in Switzerland. He had a bigger core crowd of devotees. But he was a joke in a way, you know. Hello?
Yeah, do you have any stories about people involved with him or stuff we wouldn't know about to show he was a jerk?
Not really. He represented the traditional approach to Indian philosophy, the Vedic, and he said he was expressing the Vedic lore, Vedic knowledge, you know, Vedanta. And he was just selling, he was a salesman, very clever salesman, selling India's spiritual goods, but it had no results, you know. Oh, they have all these tests and all these seminars and all these charts and, you know, all that bogus stuff, but he didn't produce anybody, and he wasn't himself, an enlightened person, you know. They're clever.
Well, what he produced was David Lynch, you know.
David Lynch. A lot of people played around with these things. The Beatles played around with it in a very short time. They figured it out that he was just a spiritual teacher, I guess. And they weren't interested really in that. They were interested in having fun, you know, having sex, taking drugs, and making money, and becoming famous.
Right, but their group is university or whatever it is. They claim that they can go into towns and meditate and make crime go down. Do you have any stories on that?
No, it's all bullshit, you know, baloney. If it worked, why hasn't the crime gone down all over the world? You know, they were claiming to levitate. Okay, well, show me the results. Guys were hopping up and down on mattresses, you know, deluding themselves into they were floating. You know, a little bit. No. If it works, if these things are valid and they work, show me the results. Where are the results? Crime is up everywhere. Bombay here, every day, someone murders somebody, someone kills somebody, the cops do in somebody. You know, someone's duped out of so many $1,000 and rupees. It's rampant, the crime. The politicians are another form of it. What do you think Bush and his buddies have done in America? They stole so much money.
But we haven't got to UG Krishnamurti, but you told me that he talks about, you know, it's good to be selfish and to make money. Isn't that what Bush and them represent?
Well, we can go into that later.
Okay, let's go into that later.
It's a metaphor. He's saying basically, look, forget about all the spirituality crap that you're interested in, you think you're interested in, because it's a dead end. It's not going to lead you anywhere. You're just going to get frustrated and be talking about this when you're 70 years old, you know? So he said, in the meantime, make money, live comfortably. You're going to be miserable anyway, but you might as well be comfortable in your misery.
Yeah, Bob, I got an idea here. It's slower. Everything was slower before World War II. And in a slower world, you could be a guru, and you could live a life, and people would believe in it, and it was a slower culture, and you could carry off the game, and nobody would be the wiser. in the speed up of the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, Krishnamurti is a transition. He had the originality that it was all an illusion. You got to go on your own. But UG lived longer and in a faster world, and even the insights that gurus offered, and we saw so many gurus coming and going, that it was the first time we saw that that traditional ancient wisdom was weak. But it was due to the technological speed up that made us arrive at the UG form of, quote, spiritual cynicism. You see what I'm saying here?
That the wisdom. I understand what you're saying. There is, you know, perhaps a progression of events or ideas that take place. I often think that that J. Krishnamurti and U.G. Krishnamurti are linked together, whether his devotees accept this or not, you know. But one was a result of the other, or not a result, but was affected by the other. And their message basically is very similar, except U.G. goes to the jugular vein quicker.
Yeah. Faster.
J.K. was a Victorian man. You know, he grew up in a Victorian world where people were polite and nice.
And slower. Slower.
Yeah, I was just talking to a guy, a Bengali guy today. He's an air steward for Lufthansa. And I was chatting with him on the internet. And, you know, he's very, very, very sweet, very nice, you know. And what I said was frightened him, you know. But because people think that way, you know. They think in this very polite, sweet way. And J. Krishnamurti was a product of that age. Also, he wanted to speak to a large audience, a larger faction, you know. And so you can't be too devastating. You can't be too, you know, direct, or you lose your audience. You know, like movie makers, the same formula works. They make a film and they have to make it for a broad audience. So it gets washed down, you know, more simplified. The more intellectual, the more clear something is, it's limited to fewer people. Even J. Krishnamurti said look, there are only a few people interested in what I'm talking about. The majority of the people want to go to the football game and go to the bar and a little bit interested in so-called spirituality. And the rest of the people aren't interested at all. In India, people go to the temple. Thousands go to the temple. They go there, ring the bell. They ask the deity for some favor, they want something, a bride, money, a job, whatever it is. They're not interested in self-understanding. They don't ask for that. The same way Catholics go to Catholic churches and they pray to the saints and Jesus and God and whatnot for something. They want something. They want to be a success. They want to be, you know, happy. They want to have a wife. They want to have kids. Whatever it is, people want. And if you tell people they want something, it disturbs them. They don't want to hear that. I told this guy today, what do you want? He said, oh, don't talk that way. What do I want? I said, well, yeah, he wants to be polite. I said, of course you want. You want something. Everybody wants. And what Yuji discovered, he said, I wanted to be free a want. And then I discovered that want was the wants of others wanting that want. In other words, if I say to myself, I want to be free, where does that come from? Is it my want, or is it the want of others in the culture that I am programmed to want? You get it?
Oh, yeah, and you're saying UG was very extreme in his expression of how to get to the wantless
state. But that, too, is a want, to be wantless.
Yeah, he canceled that.
That drove him crazy.
Well, I don't know if it drove him crazy. He was aware that he had to cancel that, too.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you had to cancel that out. Forget it. Wants are just, are not my wants, but the wants of others.
But he was stuck with other humans. What was her name, Valentine?
Stuck with himself.
Yes, but he would discharge himself with humans, beginning with the woman. What was her name, Valerie or Valentine?
Valentine?
The woman that lived with him.
Valentine.
Valentine. Okay, so he always had someone around him, and he would keep thinking of his frustration to whoever he was around, at the same time having a poise. He had contradicted. Yeah. He had solved the contradictions of his doubleness, That's why he could have energy, talk all day, and mean nothing, and not care that anybody heard him.
The question people often put to him, then why in the hell do you talk? Why are you sitting here talking? And he says, because you come here and ask this dog to bark.
Because you can't
escape. That's very clever. Very, very clever, sir. You're very clever. That hasn't answered the question.
Yes, because he was stuck with people. I mean, the best definition of humans is that
We're all stuck with people. Normal.
That's right. So humans are social. If you want to know what reality is, it's social from the anthropomorphic point of view.
Correct. We can't live without each other. We support each other. We relate to each other in some fashion or another. And we exchange with each other. I give you, you give me. This is how life keeps going.
Yeah, we block and merge. Block and merge. Block and merge. Block and merge.
Yeah.
And that's where the humor.
We're social creatures, That's why I don't want to live by myself and be a hermit. It's abnormal. See? It's ugly. I think J.K. said it was ugly.
J.K. being J. Krishnamurti.
Yeah.
But you see where humor is the resolution of the contradiction or the energy bursting. The absurdity of this situation is why people instantly laugh about everything, because they are instinctively aware of the contradiction of themselves, that they have to keep talking like we're doing now and saying nothing, but we need to talk because that's our sociality, and to the degree we want to go into the meaning of what we're saying, then you get more different kinds of emotions.
Yeah, the experts say that humor is born out of the feeling that it's the other guy, not me, who's suffering.
Yeah, that's the block part. That's the separate part. So the good part of being separate is humor.
So anyway, back to Seattle. So,
so you go to Seattle, you leave the farm system. Remember in professional hockey, they had the farm league, and you go up to the pros. So you're starting to move
moving to the pro, right. I want to compete with the Swami at the Vedanta Center in Seattle.
Yes.
I want to compete with them. I want to compete with the Universal Truth Center or Unity and the Spiritualist. I want to grab all the devotees I can and build up my own center, as it were, and become a guru.
So, right. Grace Chapman is your coach, your scout, your manager.
My supporter. Yeah, but it didn't work out that way. It didn't work out. Grace and I had some problems. So.
What were the problems?
Well, she got involved with another psychotherapist who was giving people mescaline. She had these experiences, psychedelic experiences, and she shifted away from my work, shall we say, and got involved with him. But this was kind of Grace's nature. She had been an evangelist in her early life. She believed in Jesus, and she had all kinds of experiences, and she spoke in tongues, and she graduated slowly up the spiritual ladder to what I was offering, and then to what this therapist was doing. And so we had a parting of the ways. And
over her taking mescaline, you weren't interested.
No,
in that?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that. Just her frustration, her attitude, and I sensed she wasn't 100% with me, you know.
Right.
So that was a parting of the ways.
How could one get mescaline in the 50s in Seattle? Was that common?
It was available. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Gordon Wasson surfaced in the mid 50s. You know, yeah. He went down to Mexico or someplace, and Huxley's book had been out. So maybe Huxley's book, Doors of Perception, did that popularize mescaline?
I don't know. It popularized psychedelics, you know, but that came later after Grace. I'm not sure when it was published. But anyway, no, it was
available. Doors of Perception. Doors of Perception is 54. It's about 53, 54.
Okay. So this was just slightly before or around the same time. But
no, after. You get to Seattle in 54.
Yeah. And I was there with Grace in the house there for maybe 3 or 4 months, and then we had a blow up, and so my friends found another house, and we moved. I moved.
Because you had the little cult going. You were performing. You were getting people, and they were willing to keep you and put you somewhere.
Yeah, right. So then I moved to the bigger house where I saw it was a better house, bigger drawing room. So I shifted there, and it was there that I really sort of kind of got a hold of the what I wanted to do really, without any interference or conflict from anybody else. And
what was that?
Grace was had a conflict with me.
Oh, I see. The people you had. Now, who were the people there at that point? Who began lived in that home?
Well, you see, a lot of the living people in the house weren't all directed with the center, because I was aware from my experience at the Vedanta temple that a lot of fighting was going on with the ladies that lived in the Vedic temple there with the Swami.
Yeah.
There were a lot of infighting going on. And I said, look, Robert, it's dangerous to have a lot of devotees living in the house. It doesn't lead to a healthy living relationship. So I thought it's best to get outside people living there that weren't really connected, and they could just rent rooms and help pay for the center, and as a source of income. You know, it was a 15, 16 room house. There were a lot of rooms to rent. So there was a fellow that I had met some years back. His name was Shivananda, and he was attending the University of Washington. He was a major in sociology. He had been a guru of sorts. He was a yoga teacher. He had learned yoga living in an ashram in India. Knew a little bit about Sri Aurobindo's work, but he gave that up. He figured out that it wasn't his cup of tea. So he got a green card issued by through some senator that he met in Washington, and was attending the University of Washington and getting a degree in sociology. And his name was Shivananda. He lived there. A guy named Ben Benassi, was working at Boeing. He was a Indian from the Punjab in India, and he was an engineer at Boeing. Then there was Phyllis Goodall. We spoke about her in the previous talk. She had just rented a room there, but she didn't stay there, but she used it as a kind of a guest room for herself when she needed a little space from where she lived. Then there was a couple of other people. Alice Taylor, a lady who was retired and just wanted a room, and she just lived there and wasn't connected at all to the center. And incidentally, she was the lady that left me some money in her will that financed my trip to Europe and to India later in 1966 after she died.
And she never attended your lectures. No. So why did she leave the money to you? Why? What was the point? Because
I don't know.
That's interesting. Most people think that she was impressed with your teaching. That's what I got when I read the book. She was impressed with your teaching, liked you, and left you money. But she's the one who didn't attend the courses.
No. So it was clean. It was clean.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pure. I mean, she just wanted you to continue.
She liked me and liked Connie, and she left the money to us. So, and she left it to another guy that she knew in Seattle.
Was Ralph Doobie one of these first people?
No, he came later.
Okay.
He came later, much later. After David Wister.
Right. You started to say something about the guy,
There was another engineer from Boeing lived there, too. And he was a little bit interested, but he was a voyeur. He just looked from afar, you know.
Was he Indian also? Was he Indian?
No, he wasn't. No, he was an American fellow. So... And then there was a couple of Catholic boys that lived there for a while. They were going to a Catholic university. And, it was just a nice place for them to live. They had the downstairs apartment that David Wister also had at one time. And
they were there before Wister.
Yeah, they were the first people. We used that the renting out rooms to help defray the cost of the house.
And what was the address of the house?
957 Broadway North.
And yet there was a Broadway street in Portland you were on.
Yeah. Oh, you discovered that.
There's two Broadways here. You're forever on Broadway, the theatrical part of yourself.
Yeah, Broadway,
I think you didn't finish the Alice thing. Who was it? You were going to say something about the other guy she left the money to, besides you.
Oh, I don't know the connection, but he was a friend of hers. I don't know what the connection was. But
okay.
I think it was... Yeah, I'm not sure.
Now,
anyway, I never met him, so...
So the people that are coming to... there's nobody who's seeing you speak, the members of your cult group, whatever, are living at your place. That's what's interesting. And how many days did you do this?
Do what?
Your lectures or your channeling?
Twice a week.
What days were they?
I gave a general talk on Sunday morning. Oh, and Sunday evening there was the occult section. That was the channeling. And then on Thursday evening there was a get together where we discussed and talked together in a small group. Thursday night session. Then from time to time we had events, you know. We presented to other teachers or special programs of interest and so forth.
Would you put up flyers around the community for people to come to them?
We had a mailing list, and we had a multilist press, and we printed a monthly schedule.
And so many people did this.
We had ads in the paper, Sunday section of the religious page of the talks. And
but the thing is, so many people started doing this by the 70s across America. There weren't too many people doing what you were doing in this Western way. It was more verbal. It's sort of intellectual, but the topic or the conversation was about not being intellectual and looking at what is. Did you meet Bo Kitzelman in that period?
Later on I met him, late 54 or 5 I met Bo. I met him where he lived in Nevada at Pyramid Lake.
How did you meet him?
How did that happen? He was a friend of another teacher in Portland, David Shreve, who was an ex-Scientologist, and he branched out into his own kind of system of thinking, and he called it Council House. And he was a friend of Beauregard Kitzelman. And when I went to on a lecture tour, I called it, he suggested I contact Bo and go meet him, which I did. And on the journey back to Seattle from Los Angeles, I stopped in Reno and went out to Pyramid Lake and stayed there a few days. And got to know Bo and his wife and his group of people that were living there too. He had a little group, a little ashram of people. And they were
that's
all
where
ex,
you would have
ex followers ex. Of somebody.
Right, and that's where
guy
you
named, there was a guy named Jan Kashnick who was with Beauregard, and Jan had been with an evangelist who had was traveling around the countryside in tents, you know, giving come to Jesus, you know, and Jay was told me about how they used to hire the local drunks and dredges off of First Street to come come on crutches, and then after they were healed, throw the crutches away and say Hallelujah, Jesus, you know. So I got a rude insight into the evangelistic hocus pocus that was going on.
That's the guy who was hanging.
They used to hire drunks. They used to hire drunks. Did you ever see the film Elmer Gantry?
Yes. Yeah. Time ago. Yeah.
Read the book. Yeah. Well, yeah,
yes.
That kind of a thing.
But the guy who told you, yeah, the guy who told you this told you at Kitzelman's place.
Yeah, he had been a helper in the evangelistic. He told me the tricks they did, and you know.
now do you
the scam, the inside scam, the dope, you know,
the gaff. Now, Dave Worster talks about how Kitzelman told him that L. Ron Hubbard hung out at Kitzelman's seminars at Pyramid Lake in the late 40s, and that the one person Kitzelman hated was L. Ron Hubbard because he stole Kitzelman's E-therapy to create whatever Hubbard created as Scientology.
I don't know anything about that.
Okay, now
I don't even know if David Worster ever met Kitzelman, so I don't know. Maybe he did.
They were pretty good friends eventually.
I don't know about anything. When was all that? When? What year?
In the 60s. I don't know if I don't think he met him in the 50s. He met him in the 60s, and he visited him even up into the 70s.
Maybe he did. Because it was after I left in 1960 Seattle and moved to San Francisco and was not involved in the spiritual circus, you know. So,
But the thing was, I wanted to bring up that Kitzelman, that Scientology, in the Wikipedia says it started in December 53. Now, you're at Kitzelman's in 54, 55, and this Shreve guy has already been in Scientology and left.
Yeah.
Right,
first it was Dianetics, then Scientology, and then it went on to other forms, you know, they call it something else. And then later the Forum. No, that form is the other fellow. Excuse me,
Werner Erhard.
Yeah, another hustler. So.
Yeah, but the thing is, you do talk about David Shreve in your book. I mean, does he help you move up to Seattle? I think
No. He used to come with his wife, and then they used to share the podium. You know, he would give a talk, and I would come to Portland and give a talk at his center, and. And then Connie and I turned David on to LSD, gave his first session.
David Shreve.
In Seattle.
Now, I think Worster says that Kitzelman spoke at the center. You remember that?
No.
You don't remember that? That doesn't seem accurate. But
no.
Kitzelman, you visited Kitzelman, but you didn't get too involved with him after.
I saw him in 1960 in Ojai when Krishnamurti was giving his talks there. And Kitzelman was there with his family, and David Shreve was there, and I can't remember David Worster, but I believe he was, I'm not sure if he was there.
Worster was not there in 1960. But Dave Millett was. Dave
yeah,
Millett.
David came along, yeah.
David Millett, yes.
Worster
was back in the looking after maybe Shivananda. The guy Ed Young or somebody was left back at the center when you went. Well, you closed it.
We didn't close it then. Maybe, yeah, somebody was there. But on my first journey out of the center, to when I met Kitzelman, and I was in Los Angeles and San Francisco, a former monk of Yogananda ashram was staying at my house. I offered him shelter because he was homeless and didn't have a place to stay. And he was staying there, and he gave some talks when I was gone, and there was a little problem with him. Ray Eugene Davis. Eugene Davis was his name. And he's still writing books and giving talks and on yoga, meditation, spirituality. He lives in Florida, I think.
He's still doing it.
Yeah.
Yes, when you Worcester talks about whoever was left in the center, that's who Dave hung out with and got to know. It might have been Shivananda. I'm not sure. It's on the tape of the Worcester interviews. And so he did not go to Ojai in 1960, which was a radical experience for you, because Krishnamurti finally made you realize you want to stop being having a center.
Well, it wasn't Krishnamurti. It was nothing he said directly to me in any words, or it was just seeing him, listening to him. It just hit me that what I was doing was falsifying my own search and the search of others.
Right, you saw the pure example of that in Krishnamurti, and then you wanted to up your standards of what you were doing.
Yeah.
But let's go back to your teaching in Seattle, and then is the next dramatic thing when LSD enters your world, or is there something before that?
No, I was beginning to feel that I wanted to drop the psychic element, you know. Here's the thing. If I used to offer an evening of psychic predictions, you know, psychic science, you know, I used to fill the center with people. And they would pay money to come to that. And I used to go, Jesus, you know, they're not interested at all in self-understanding. They just want to be entertained with what's going to happen to me. Am I going to buy a refrigerator or a new car? Or, you know, they wanted a trivial experience, you know, a psychic experience they wanted. And if I am party to that, I'm falsifying myself and them too. And so that began to gnaw on me. What am I doing? Can I really helping in any way, or am I just keeping them, amusing them, entertaining them? And so I begin to have
This is where you're a philosopher. You don't like phoniness, or you want seriousness around you.
The
philosopher part of yourself.
The Krishnamurti, I read Krishnamurti, and it was hitting, you know, it was a part of my thinking. I was thinking in those terms.
And would those concepts come? Would those concepts come through during your channeling?
Yeah, same thing. Yeah.
Do you think that was you processing Krishnamurti, and then your so-called other entity took you over, was a part of your unconscious, and was saying the Krishnamurti wisdom?
I think that whatever filters down through these experiences gets washed by your own personality, gets affected by your own personality. So it's a co-experience, co-venture.
Yes.
So Edgar Casey said that. He said, whatever I say is altered by my own interest in Christianity and the Bible, he said.
Yes. So you have this conflict, which is always with you, intensified. So you're going to drop the predicting and maybe even the channeling.
Yeah, and so then I went to Victoria to give a talk, and just a talk, just Robert talking, you know. and not any channeling or any psychic things. And it was then that I said, oh, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to stop it. No? So
you
then I had a powwow.
Are you saying you were
going to
stop channeling? Yeah, but, so you, but you're talking.
But I had a powwow with my mentor, my master on the other side. And I said, look, it's time to come to an end to this. And the answer was yes, stop.
And that was in Victoria?
It started there. It hit me there. I was out. I had gone to some kind of, my hostess where I was staying invited me to attend some kind of unity meeting held by the unity people. And it was in some big state, and everybody was outside holding hands and forming a circle and thinking good thoughts and having, you know, they were creating an experience for themselves, and I couldn't become involved in it. I just walked away, and I walked out in the middle of this field, kind of this meadow, and I said to myself, what, you know, what's going on? You know, I was in conflict, you know, and I heard a voice deep inside me. It said, Robert, be true to thine own self. I said, okay, that's it. I'm finished. So that was it.
But does that mean you will still talk, give talks?
Yeah, but I would talk myself, not using the flower, the decorations, and, you know, the imagery of the other.
And this is about, let's say, 55, 56, about a year before you meet Worcester?
Yeah, because I had finished the channeling when David came.
Right.
And then what happened then was that the center took a new direction. Instead of people looking for psychic phenomena, we were attracting other kinds of people, a little more intellectual kinds of people. So... But a lot of the people stayed on with me. The Noises, Dr. Noyes and his wife and his mother and the Maletz and Phyllis Goodall was stronger than ever.
You mean the Maletz came to the center?
Yeah. They used to attend.
Right.
They were one of the first people to come. They used to come to the hotel, Stewart Hotel, when I was giving... talks there prior to coming to Seattle. They were the core group. The mother, Sybil, the father, and the two daughters, and David.
Yeah, and they knew of Krishnamurti by then too, I think.
They were introduced to Krishnamurti, yeah. Yeah, we used to sell Krishnamurti's books, and I found a bookstore in India, in Bombay, that was publishing all kinds of books on Krishnamurti by other people, by a French writer and by Indian writers. So I wrote to them and said, send me your books. And I sent them, $50 or something, and I got a trunk load of books because the books were really cheap then. And so those books were sold at the center, plus Harper's books, Krishnamurti, his book, The First and Last Freedom, and his books, his interviews with people, his books were there, part of the curriculum.
And this is before Worcester shows up.
About the same time.
Right, because you know I've met Sybil 40 years ago. I met Sybil Yeah, I know David. I was just with David in 2001 at Worcester's apartment in Everett, Washington. So it's interesting that I met them in 69. Sybil, I forget the daughter, the one that was the composer, musical composer.
Mary,
right, Mary. And David. So they were part of the scene almost 40 years ago.
Yeah,
and
they were teenagers. David was a teenager, you know. And Mary was a little bit older, and her sister, who unfortunately died, she killed herself. And the mother also killed herself, Sybil's mother. She drowned in Lake Washington. She tied herself
Sybil's
to
mother.
A,
Sybil's mother did that.
Yeah.
And Mary's sister, that was in the 50s or 60s?
50s.
Okay, yeah. So we're talking about this period where you're having intellectuals, and that's when Agnananda, or however you say his name, showed.
Leopold Fischer, his German name, and his Indian name was Swami Agnananda Bharti. He was a monk in India, Swami, and he first was a soldier in the German army in Africa. He was conscripted, you know, when he was 18 years old. He lived in Austria, and he was an intellectual, a giant intellectual. He learned Sanskrit when he was 15 or 16 years old. He was a genius, language genius. And after the war was over, he left. He got out of the German army. He was, naturally, when the British and the Americans captured him. And he went to India and joined the Ramakrishna Mission in Calcutta. But he found he didn't fit into, he was a loose rogue, a loose peg or something, you know.
He was like Wally, a rebel.
Yeah, and he didn't fit. So he eventually left the Ramakrishna Mission, and he took initiation in Benares by a Swami there who initiated him into the Bharti order of Swami. There are four main groups in India, probably subgroups too, but there are four more main schools. And he then wandered all over India teaching Vedanta, Swami.
Yeah.